Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Willow Belden. There have been rumors that Fremont County is experiencing a rise in gambling addiction amongst its residents. Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Joroff reports that whether the rumors are true or not is still unclear, but some services are popping up to address it regardless.
The Wind River Hotel and Casino in Riverton is full of chirping slot machines, game tables, bright lights, and gamblers. There are different opinions regarding how much good gaming has brought to the county and tribes, but there is also concern about gambling addictions.
In 2006 is when I probably started gambling compulsively.
That's a compulsive gambler in recovery we'll call Anna, who did not want her real name used.
Started out just like everyone else, going out with $20. Went out with my friend, we would have dinner, play a little bit, laugh and joke, and it was all fun. It continued to be fun for a while, and then the amount of money we put in went up, and then it just got out of hand.
Anna declined to share the details of her story, except to say that it got real bad. We met at a Gamblers Anonymous meeting in a church located just a couple minutes' drive from the big casino. Only two of the five regulars attended that particular meeting, one of whom was the organizer, who also didn't want her name used. She started the meetings when a friend sought help and found no resources in the community. She got in touch with the International Gamblers Anonymous office, found the space for the meetings, and bought materials out of pocket.
Gambling isn't spoke of. Nobody talks about it. You know, even with all the casinos we have in Fremont County, nobody talks about gambling and people losing their houses, losing everything they own. It happens all the time.
The organizer and Anna are both clear that it's not the casino's fault, but they say that gambling addiction is still very much a problem. There are no statistics about whether the number of gambling addicts is increasing. Here's Fremont County prosecuting attorney Brian Varn.
I don't know that I can say that it's been an increase for certain. I know that in the last 4 years, we've had around eight cases in which the defendants themselves told us that the reason they had been involved in embezzlement and theft from their employers was because of their gambling.
He suspects other cases were also linked to gambling, but he can't be sure. Varn says those numbers aren't exactly an epidemic, and the Gamblers Anonymous meetings aren't overflowing either. But the National Council of Problem Gambling estimates that there are 8,000 problem gamblers and 4,000 pathological gamblers in Wyoming. Executive Director of the Council, Keith White, says nobody actually counts, so the numbers could be higher. In the past 6 months, the Council's hotline received an average of 50 calls a month from Wyoming. White says part of the problem is that gambling is legal, and gambling addiction isn't often seen as an illness.
Until recently, it hasn't been seen as also a public health problem. The state has been very slow to address it and respond to it, just like other diseases like diabetes or drug abuse or depression, although we see them and the medical community sees them as all very similarly related.
The Fremont County Counseling Service is one entity that is taking the issue seriously, despite the lack of data. They're starting a gambling awareness group that will teach classes about signs and symptoms of gambling addiction, what to look out for, and how to engage someone who may be a problem gambler. So far, demand for the class has been low. For now, though, Director of Fremont Counseling Service, Jerry McAdams, says the class is still worth holding.
Need and demand are two different things. I'm not opposed to doing things that when I know there's a need, but then at some point in time, we have to catch up the need and the demand together where we can run a viable program.
The Wind River Casino recognizes there is a problem, too. The casino's Andrea Clifford says they've seen it affect their employees. The casino has brought in specialists to train all staff on problem gambling awareness and train local counselors to specialize in gambling addiction. They also provide self-exclusion, where people self-identify themselves and are asked to leave the casino if found there. But the organizer and Anna both said it doesn't work. Finally, the casino used to help out with GA meetings in the past. Currently, however, Clifford says casino staff is stretched thin, and it doesn't help that there aren't other resources in the area.
It was kind of hard for us because when we called the national hotline for problem gambling, they didn't even realize that Wyoming had casinos here. So, you know, we were kind of like, yeah, we're here, we've been here, and we need some services and some help.
Current GA meetings convene at the Church of Christ in Riverton every Monday at 6 p.m. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Irina Zhorov.
Issues that include alcohol, tobacco, and suicide are serious problems in Wyoming. In recent months, community prevention specialists in each county in the state have been compiling a needs assessment developed by the Wyoming Survey and Analysis Center, or WISAC. The specialists are trying to identify the extent of the problem in each of the three topic areas, and the next step is to try and find some solutions. Rich Lindsay, who represents the Prevention Management Organization of Wyoming, says they pick those topic areas for a reason.
When you look at some of the figures in terms of what we have in terms of alcohol, the cost of tobacco to this state, and suicide, the number of suicides that we have in this state given other neighboring states, there are problems that need to be addressed.
Who were you talking to get this information?
Some of them would talk to school members, school board members. They would talk to, in particular, law enforcement. They may talk to other organizations. They were also required to have town hall meetings, up to three of them, where they would invite the community in, and they would have a set of questions that they would ask the community about. You know, do you foresee these problems? Do you see these problems existing in terms of underage drinking, et cetera? And then kind of and take notes on what people had to say.
Were there themes across the state that you have ID'd yet?
There are what we call causal areas in terms of alcohol. For example, retail availability, where it's too easy for kids to get alcohol and from retailers, or social availability, where there are house parties or community events, where the way alcohol is sold and consumed at community events it can be done in a better fashion. There are five of those causal areas, and two of them were identified by many, many of the counties across the state, and those were social availability and community events.
So community events being like a Frontier Days, Jubilee Days, or a rodeo or something like
That's exactly right.
And kids and underage kids would have an opportunity to get
Yeah, them. And that really – what that amounts to is that sometimes – there are things that you can do in terms of selling and the consumption of alcohol at a community event that kids don't see that it's just a free-for-all with alcohol, and it also keeps things safe, like having a beer garden where only adults can go to drink, for example, or two drink minimums, and wristbands that show how old people are, that they're 21 and older. There are things like that.
We talk a lot about underage drinking. Was anything identified with people who are of legal age, binge drinking or DUIs or anything along those lines?
Yes. I think you could safely say that there is a binge drinking problem when you consider community events. But the one that you touched on that's really true is binge drinking will show up particularly in the area of DUIs across the state. And that is a problem that we have. And nationally, when you look at our statistics, we're above the national average in terms of DUIs.
Rich Lindsay's visiting with us, talking about some of the comprehensive plans that have been developed across the state. Let me ask you about tobacco, because when you look at some numbers, it would look to me like some of the tobacco issues in our state are improving. I'm curious what people found in doing this.
I think what you find in terms of tobacco, yeah, there are some numbers that have kind of leveled off. There has been improvement over the years. However, there are other things that still can be done to bring those numbers lower, one. And two, when you look at the impact of what tobacco has, for example, on Medicaid and on all the kinds of chronic diseases that happen because of tobacco, it's a fairly large impact in terms of the general health of this state.
What's been done has mostly been done, it seems to me, maybe at the state level. Is the thought that maybe you do some more things locally?
Yes. Actually, the whole purpose of the Prevention Management Organization Wyoming is to help communities do stuff on their own. They make their decisions about what they're going to do. So, yes, it's kind of a community by community set of actions to improve.
The last piece, suicide, you know, it's at all age levels, a lot of men involved in this activity. Anything new developed here as that you learned from this survey?
What was learned was that there are a set of best practices that can be implemented by communities, particularly in the terms of raising the awareness about suicide and training people in identifying suicide possibilities, and also some perhaps policy changes that need to take place on a state level to improve how people are able to attend to people that maybe have had depression for a long time and could be candidates for suicide.
So real quickly, we've had the counties come up with this information. Now what happens? Does this sit on a shelf, or are people doing something with these things?
Community coalitions will get together. They'll see what causal areas are the problems, and then they will pick an intervention or two to work on over the next 12 or 18 months to try and get passed, if it's a city ordinance that's involved, or maybe a fair board changing a policy, and try and get those implemented that will make a difference.
In each of these areas?
In each of those areas and in each of the communities.
Okay, so we can be looking for those here in coming months and weeks, and people should be looking for these things in their own community if they'd like to weigh in on them?
That's a good point, Bob. Those community coalitions meetings to make those decisions will be happening primarily in the month of January. And that's a chance for anybody, any citizen to go and cast their vote for what they think the change should be in the community, and then work on stuff if they want to.
Rich Lindsay, thank you so much.
Thanks very much, Bob. Appreciate it.
When we come back, we'll have an interview with Wyoming School Superintendent Cindy Hill. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck. It's safe to say for the last year or so there's been some friction between the state superintendent Cindy Hill and some members of the legislature. Lawmakers have charged that Hill has opposed some of the recently passed legislation dealing with making teachers more accountable. And a Legislative Service Office report suggested that the State Department of Education had not fulfilled many legislatively mandated duties, such as setting up a panel to set standards for student performance. Hill says such reports are inaccurate. While she admits to having disagreements with some lawmakers, including the Senate Education Committee Chairman Hank Coe, she does not see the disagreements as problematic. She says news coverage of these disagreements have taken away the focus on improving education in Wyoming. Superintendent Hill joins us today to discuss some of these issues, and she begins by explaining her concerns about the accountability legislation.
The Wyoming Accountability and Education Act is complex and engages the legislature, the Joint Education Committee, individual education committees of both houses, the Joint Select Committee on Accountability, the Advisory Committee to the Select Committee, the Ad Hoc Committee to the Advisory Committee, the LSO, the newly created DETS, the State Board, the Wyoming Department of Education, the Superintendent, and various consultants and liaisons. You can imagine to meaningfully engage all of those folks, it's incredibly important that we have a process and a structure from which to work with. And that's been a challenge.
Is it a challenge because there's just so many people working on this? Is that what you're trying to say?
Well, and one of the groups I didn't mention were the districts, the students, the teachers, the parents. I would say that any time you're working on something as complex and as important as this, that structure of communication, I would say, is critical. And that has not been as clear, perhaps, as everyone would have maybe liked.
You had a report that came out via the Legislative Service Office that was essentially critical of the department, thinking that because of turnover you've had and maybe some other reasons that some of the efforts have been delayed. My understanding is you object to that report, and I wondered if you'd like to comment on that.
Well first, it's really puzzling that it was mentioned that we missed deadlines, because the WDE has not missed one deadline, Bob, and our response will include the supporting documentation that will reflect those facts. You also mentioned, regarding whether or not this process could yield a viable result? And I say yes. But I also think the public is owed a process that is transparent and accessible so that the final product is ultimately viable. Bob, I defeated a very popular senator. You know, their colleague wasn't elected for some of them. In their hearts, they've suffered a loss. And I will say that in a larger sense, you know, we'll all be judged for what we do in Wyoming. And I just hope that we can move from those, arise from those petty grievances that perhaps might still be there, and set aside, you know, all of our self-interest and turn to the work, and that work is before us. It's right here before us. And I want you to know that the department was tasked with doing some work, and we've submitted that to the legislature. In fact, we're the only body that did actually submit information. But we know that there's a lot more work ahead of us. And I would say that if we all can set aside our own self-interest, we'll get there. But I also think it's a little bit, you know, just part of the natural process of things as well. I don't think we're always going to agree. But when the conversations don't take place, that's difficult to work through.
A couple of thoughts. Again, Cindy Hill, State Superintendent, visiting with us. It does look like there have been some shots fired over the bow from the legislature towards you. But I'm wondering if you haven't caused some of that yourself. There was some spending issues last year, moving some money around to, I guess, that legislators felt should have been spent in some other areas. There obviously was a confrontation with Senator Coe during the legislature, even a recent radio program, as I understand. Do you need to work a little bit better with them as well and maybe follow some of their directives?
I think that it's important that we all reflect on our behavior and always hope to improve, but I would also mention to you that the money that you're referring to, we completed a nearly $20 million audit, and we came through with flying colors. There was no issue around what you're describing, and I would hope that you would report that, even though you alluded to what was alleged during the legislative session. That audit was not reported. I would have liked to have seen you know, more response to the good work that my department is doing and the responsible behavior that we continue to show. So I think that innuendos are not helpful. And I think that, you know, I know that I hold no ill will towards Senator Coe. I do speak to when things are not factual, and I will continue to. You know, I don't answer to certain legislators. I answer to the people as an elected official, and I will continue to do so.
When you look at test scores and you look at some of the things that have been going on, I mean, are you confident we're heading in the right direction?
The scores are trending upward, Bob. I think teachers should be recognized for the work, and the students and the parents for the work that's showing we are going in the right direction. And yet, we know that there's always more work to be done. And so, you know, the question is, do we need a big stick, or do we need to work together? And I would say, I think we need goals and targets, and then I think we all must work together. It's required. It's incumbent upon us. And for those who are not willing to, I can't control them, but I know I am. And I know that we're doing that in districts throughout the state, and we'll continue to do it. And I know that the WDE is less fragmented than it was when I walked in. And for those who are here, they're mission-oriented and focus on growing kids in our schools. And that wasn't there when I came in necessarily everywhere. Compliance was our focus, and we were in different spots and different places, and now we're all focused on the same mission. And our work, yep, we're doing more work. And I see people in this department smiling. In fact, someone called this morning, and I have an appointment with that person here shortly. They'd like to come back to the department. So we have great people, highly qualified people who are working very hard every day. And just like the teachers in Wyoming, I think we need to get in and support one another and put these political pieces, feelings aside, even though I know that it's a very emotional time.
Cindy Hill, I appreciate you making time for us as always, and thank you very much. And we'll be chatting with you in coming weeks. Thank you for joining us on Open Spaces.
After we finished that interview, State Superintendent Cindy Hill called back and asked if she could make an additional comment.
Bob, when we're making these changes, and possibly significant changes in Wyoming, I'm thinking there is so much opportunity here. And so even when we disagree, that opportunity to talk about the work that's going on at the department, the work that's going on in the legislature, the work that's going on in the district, we all need to be at the table, and we all need to be listening to each other so that the opportunities are seized rather than missed. And that's what I'm most hopeful about, is that when this report came out that you were referring to, we have an opportunity now, my staff, to talk about the good work that's been going on and explain the complexity, but also to gain some understanding and to share some of that understanding with others. So that's what I'm hoping happens, and I think it can. I think it can if others are interested in making it happen. So opportunity, opportunity, opportunity. That's what I want to focus on here, Bob.
And it is your point that, I mean, it is your strong belief that there are positive things happening.
There are many positive things happening. That's why we need to focus, I think, if we focus on that which we agree upon, and then those decisions are coming forth that maybe we haven't agreed upon yet. There are some things that I didn't agree upon in the beginning, and then there are decisions made, and I am fully in support of them now. And so we have to agree that even after we have that discussion, that once a decision's made, that we all go forward together, and that it's okay to have the discussion. In fact, it's okay to even have ruffled feathers, because it's an emotional time right now. There are people who are very much invested in what's going on, so it's to be predicted.
Do you believe that you can all set that aside and get a product? Because, you know, when you hear some of the things or read some of the comments in newspapers or elsewhere, you worry that, gosh, can these guys ever get together and get a good product?
Absolutely. There's no ill will here. I will tell you, we must do it. And I will. I know that I can speak for my part, and I know that I can and I will. And so I'm just hoping that others feel the same.
State Superintendent of Public Instruction Cindy Hill will get to meet again with legislators in a couple of weeks and hopes to address charges made about the department in the Legislative Service Office study.
When we come back, we'll hear about a push to get dual language immersion programs started in schools in Casper, and we'll hear from a longtime Jeffrey City resident about how the town has changed since the last uranium boom. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Willow Belden. A group of parents are trying to get dual language immersion programs set up in Casper. They'd like two elementary schools to start these programs, and the focus would be on Spanish and Chinese. Taya True Wells is the parent who's spearheading the effort. She joined me on the phone to talk about it, along with Ann Tollefson, an outside consultant who has evaluated dual language programs in other states. So, Taya, how would this program work?
Well, great. Thanks for having us on. Dual language immersion can mean many different things. There's many different formats. What we are aiming for is something called a one-way 50-50 dual language immersion. And what that means is that we are taking English speakers and immersing them for half their day in the second language and then half their day in English. And during the second language, the students will learn their math in the second language. They'll learn science, civics. And then when they transition to their English part of the day, they will do reviews, short reviews on those so that they know the English vocabulary. But then they'll also get English literature and reading. So that they're not losing the ability to speak and read in English, that they're staying up with that, but they're also being able to learn and understand and read in a second language.
And obviously you'd like to set up two dual language programs in Casper, one in Spanish and one in Chinese. Why those two languages?
You know, that's a great question. Right now those are the two languages that I have a group of parents that are pushing for. I would love it if there were some more parents that would say, I want French we would totally start backing a French program. You know, we could do German, we could do Portuguese. It doesn't matter the language. You know, it matters that they are learning a language, because a second language is a gift that we can give them.
Why is it such an important gift to have a second language? Why is it so important to do a dual language program in Casper?
I really like the image of the three blind men and the elephant, you know, and everybody seeing sort of a different part of the elephant. And so if we look at parents, I think the value that a dual language immersion brings to parents is that we begin teaching them a language when they're biologically open and ready to learn language. And it doesn't, the program as it's structured, doesn't add one more thing to our already busy lives. You know, this is not going to Mandarin class, you know, that's one more thing piled on top of us. This is just changing the way that we're teaching our kids. So it doesn't overload us. So that's sort of one way to look at the dual language immersion system. Another way is from the education system. The students lose nothing academically. They are right there with their monolingual peers in math and in reading ability, reading comprehension. And then sort of the third way to look at dual language immersion is from the business community. And here we are in Wyoming, right? We're landlocked. We have no ocean. We're in the middle of a country that's huge. And yet we have businesses that deal with individuals and other companies in Latin America. Here in Casper, there's one that deals with Papua New Guinea and Israel. Other companies deal with countries all around Asia, and Russia is another one. And not only are we going out to the world, but the world is coming to us. I mean, if you look at the Powder River Basin, CNOOC, which is the Chinese National Offshore Oil Company, they are investing heavily with Chesapeake Oil in the Powder River Basin. I mean, they are here. So the business community gets it that we can't have, you know, while our state may be landlocked, we can't have a business landlocked mentality. And I don't want the educational system and that mentality to be landlocked as well.
Anne, I want to turn to you for a moment. Obviously, you've evaluated dual language programs in other states. How well do they work in terms of getting students fluent in a second language?
Well, I'll tell you, having observed these programs across the country, it is amazing how well the children do. You can walk in, for example, to a first grade classroom where the children are learning Chinese, math in Chinese, and I'm not sure they know it's Chinese. They just think it's math. You can walk into a fourth grade classroom, and you can hear children who are telling jokes in Chinese or in Spanish or in French. Those children are at the advanced level of language proficiency by the time they leave middle school. By the time they leave sixth grade, they're at the intermediate high level. And an intermediate high speaker means that you can't just ask where the bathroom is and order from a menu, but you can actually engage in a cogent conversation. You can ask questions with native speakers. You can read a newspaper, etc. So their language proficiency is incredible because, in a way, traditional language programs teach language, but immersion programs teach in language. So children are learning math, they're learning social studies, they're learning science in the language. So it's just a natural part of their daily life. I'm not sure they even make a distinction between English and Chinese or Portuguese.
And I want to sort of snowball on something that Taya mentioned earlier in terms of looking at how children who are in dual language programs, immersion programs, how they do with other subjects. Are they still as proficient in English, in math, in science, in some of these other areas?
You know, we have a huge body of research that goes back probably 20 years. A large part of it is recent, and we're doing some in Utah with almost 4,000 children already. And what we're finding is, number one, that when you control for every variable in your research studies, that children in these immersion programs do at least as well, and most of them do better, than children who spend their whole day in English.
Taya, I want to go back to you for a moment. What is next? What do you need to accomplish in order for these programs to get off the ground?
Well, what our timeline looks like is we are doing a joint proposal with the Natrona County School District. So the district and the parents are coming to the Board of Trustees, the Natrona County School Board Trustees, and we are proposing that we begin dual language immersion next fall. And if they give the thumbs up, what we will do then is we will approach principals, we will approach teachers, and we will educate them on how the progression would work, because we're not going to convert a whole school immediately. We start with the kindergartners and maybe a first grade. And then the following year we'll add one more grade. And then the following year we'll add one more. So this is not a system that will change immediately, because you need to build from the bottom up to make it really successful. And hopefully a school will pick us up, and if not, we will start advocating to open our own school. And I don't want to do that immediately, but that would be somewhere we would look to go. I think it is that important that Wyoming and especially kids in Casper have this opportunity.
All right. Well, Taya True-Wells and Ann Tollefson, thanks so much for visiting with us.
Willow, thank you for having us on.
J.D. Darnell is a resident of Jeffrey City and has served as sheriff's deputy since the 1970s. The town is a lot quieter now than it was during the last uranium boom, which brought miners to the region and plenty of excitement. That was all over by the mid-80s. Darnell looks back on Jeffrey City then and now.
The first company that ever came in here was Western Nuclear, and that was 1957 when the town started. It was a pretty wild and woolly operation. Big percentage of the population was single guys. It was a real transient type population. You know, you'd have several hundred people move in 1 week, and a month later they'd move out, and there'd be a whole other set moved in replacing them. There for couple of years, we were right around 5,100 people. There were three deputies besides myself. Pretty much day in, day out, you could expect at least one bar fight and probably at least one or two family fights. Kept you going pretty much 24/7. There was a considerable amount of controlled substances being abused around the area. So pretty wild time. We had Jeffrey City newspaper, a deputy county attorney stationed here. Once a week they'd come out and hold court out here. We had our own bank. We had three restaurants with bars attached, two liquor stores, three service stations, the Daylight Donut franchise, had a little Montgomery Ward's outlet store, a Cobra Tire shop, two grocery stores, a Napa door, had a lumber yard and a glass shop, car wash and a laundromat, had a little pizza shop. They had three different shifts going to these different mines, so you had kind of one shift working and one shift sleeping and one shift partying. So it was quite the bustling little place. When I was in my 20s, that was just fine. Right now, being in my 60s, the current status is just fine. Got everybody just scattered at the four winds, same way with most of the housing here. Most of the houses, they packed up onto house movers. There's houses from Jeffrey City and Lander, Riverton, Casper, Rollins. There's at least one in Fort Collins. Just everywhere you look, you can find a house that used to be in Jeffrey City, Wyoming at one time. And especially in the summers, there'll be an outfit kind of driving around, stopping here all over town sort of thing. It's somebody that, I lived here in 1978 for 2-3 years. They're passing through and they decide to stop and look at the old hometown, so to speak. And So I run into quite a few of them just about all the time. Mostly it's pretty peaceable. There's not a whole lot going on. I was raised on a ranch west of here, so the area has always pretty much been home. And after 61 years, it kind of grows on you.
Jeffrey City might look like a lonely area to some, but it can also be inspirational. Laramie writer and poet Lori Howe shares her thoughts in this piece called Jeffrey City, Wyoming.
The morning gold of the prairie, soft before the heat comes, smooths the wrinkled streets of the town, gilds humble phone lines and street signs, transfers the dark lines of swings and slides into their lightest negative. A fox rounds a weed-blown fence with something small and still in its mouth. And still, the fox is beautiful, carmine in early light. In Jeffrey City, the sky is clean because the wind meets no resistance, and the scents of sage and alkali no longer mingle with coffee, eggs, cigarette smoke, the exhaust of cars warming in driveways. There are no kettles, no keys, no lighters or dimes jangling in this town. There are no cars, no food, no people. It is as if all the brick houses that once edged these sidewalks were built, unknowing, along the veins and fingers of an enormous hand. And one ordinary morning, it closed reflexively. Those same pots, keys, lighters, change and lives jangling lightly inside it, and stowed itself in a dark, seamless pocket. Out here, the desert sings of homecoming and permanence with a forked tongue. Spitting rust, yellow cake, and peeling paint down empty streets paved to last so much longer than anyone could live here. I'm Lori Howe.
When we come back, we'll take a trip to the Wildlife Forensics Lab in Laramie, and we'll hear about the Black Dog Animal Rescue. This is Open Spaces.
This is Open Spaces. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck. Each year, the Game and Fish Department discovers dozens of wildlife crimes in Wyoming. They range from hunting without a license to killing an animal from the road. The department takes these infractions very seriously and runs a cutting-edge wildlife forensics lab to investigate them. Willow Belden visited the lab and filed this report.
Wildlife officials usually find out about poaching when someone discovers a kill that seems fishy. For example, someone stumbles across a headless carcass or a pile of guts in an area that's off limits to hunting. Wyoming's chief game warden Brian Nesvik says when that happens, wildlife investigators visit the scene and look for a suspect.
We had one incident where we could tell exactly what had happened by the vehicle tracks and by the shell casings and by this dead deer carcass without a head that was laying there. We could tell that they'd shot this deer off the road the night before, and they left behind a coffee cup. And it was a very unique styrofoam coffee cup that only one business in town sold.
So the investigators went to that business, and within an hour, they found their suspect. Once they have a suspect, investigators often collect samples of meat from the person's freezer, or hairs from an animal head on the wall, or blood from a kitchen knife. And they send the evidence to the Wildlife Forensics Lab in Laramie.
The lab is probably one of the nation's leading wildlife forensic type labs. They're our CSI for wildlife in Wyoming, if you will.
The lab is not what you might picture for a high-tech forensics facility. It's housed in a windowless set of rooms at the University of Wyoming, and the scuffed wood cabinets and worn black tabletops give it the feel of a science classroom from a bygone era. Yet the facility does advanced detective work, like DNA analysis. Dee Dee Hawk is in charge of the lab. She shows me a white machine that looks kind of like a mini refrigerator.
So this is the hardware of the DNA sequencer.
Hawk opens the machine. Inside is a pool of gel. Her colleague brings over tiny containers of DNA bathed in a purple liquid and injects the DNA into the gel. One set of DNA is from an elk carcass found in the field. Other samples are from meat found at the defendant's house. Hawk says the machine uses lasers to analyze the DNA.
And what we end up with when we're done is kind of like a barcode for each piece of evidence. So we compare that barcode from one piece of evidence to the barcode from the other piece of evidence, and they have to match exactly to say that they came from the same animal.
In other words, they can figure out whether the elk remains from the field came from the same animal as the meat in the suspect's freezer. And that's how they catch poachers. Hawk says one memorable case involved a trophy elk that was killed in an area where hunting was not allowed.
They brought it out and loaded it in the back of their pickup, and they drove off to another area, did some additional hunting. When they came back out of the area, there was a bear in the back of their truck eating on the elk that they had just poached.
They shot the bear and called the game warden, who confiscated the bear.
At the time, he was asking, you know, questions about the elk because it was such a trophy. And their answers were, you know, a little bit hinky, but he didn't have enough information to do anything about it.
2 weeks later, someone found a pile of guts in an area that was closed to hunting. So the game warden sent the bear and a sample from the gut pile to the forensics lab.
We found elk tissue in the claws of the bear, and we matched that tissue back to the kill site.
The hunters were later convicted. John Demery is a wildlife investigator in Laramie. He's been in the business for 35 years, and he says the forensics lab has changed the way they investigate crimes. In the past, they had no way to match samples from the crime scene to evidence at the suspect's home.
We'd have to work harder at either getting confessions or eyewitnesses or other evidence that we could get for conviction.
In addition to catching poachers, game warden Brian Nesvik says the lab can track down wildlife that attacks humans.
For example, we had an individual who was attacked by a grizzly bear and killed, and we needed to know which bear, for sure, was the bear that was involved in that.
Nesvik says they typically collect biological samples from grizzly bears when they collar them, and they keep those samples on file. So in this case, within 24 hours, the forensics lab was able to match one of the samples on file to hair from the scene of the attack. With that, they determined which bear was the culprit and euthanized it. Running the lab costs hundreds of thousands of dollars each year, but Nesvik says it's worth it.
We believe it's important to invest sportsmen's dollars in this because they expect us to protect wildlife and to make sure everybody's playing fair.
Nesvik says Game and Fish only knows about 5 or 10% of the poaching cases that occur. But when they do find out about a case, they're able to catch the perpetrators 50 to 75% of the time, and they often fine the offenders thousands of dollars. Their hope is that that will serve as a deterrent against future poaching. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Willow Belden.
Thank you.
Wyoming animal shelters are overcrowded, and that means many pets get killed every year. But some organizations are taking an aggressive approach in trying to get more animals adopted and have fewer animals put to death. One of those is the Black Dog Animal Rescue in Cheyenne. The program involves a number of volunteers and a strong online and social media effort. Bob Beck reports.
This is the office of the Black Dog Animal Rescue. The executive director and founder is Brittany Wallace, who's sitting with a dog named Jessie that she's trying to get adopted. Yeah. Wallace is an animal lover who wanted to decrease euthanasia rates at Wyoming animal shelters.
I knew that we could only do that by advocating for that kind of reform and change in those organizations, but also providing a very visible alternative to euthanasia.
They started by taking in some dogs that shelters deemed to be non-adoptable with the goal of putting them in foster homes. Jessie is one of those dogs. These were dogs that were in the shelter for long periods of time. Later, they also took in dogs that people could no longer care for. Shelter dogs are sometimes viewed as inferior. Sometimes it's because the dogs are a mixed breed. Some lack social skills, and others do not interact well with people. The concept is that foster parents could correct any problems and make the dogs more adoptable. They do this by bringing the dogs into their homes and have them interact with their families, including their own dogs. Wallace says at any given time, they have between 25 and 35 dogs in foster care.
Those people that do agree to do it, that step up to the plate to help us save these animals, are just really extraordinary people. And while the dogs live there, the program provides for all of their needs. So we feed them, we pay for their vet expenses, we give the foster homes toys and training tools, and they have access to behaviorists and trainers to work with.
Wallace says they are always searching for more foster homes.
Well, he's looking pretty healthy, so.
Yeah, he's looking pretty healthy.
This is an event just outside the historic depot in downtown Cheyenne. A number of Black Dog Animal Rescue volunteers are on hand with some dogs available for adoption. Events like this one is one of the ways that the rescue gets people to adopt animals. While they have an active website and social media approach, here people can meet the dogs.
This is Dobby.
This is Dobby. And who's this?
Tara.
They do a number of events like this throughout the year in various communities. Those who foster dogs normally have one or more of their own, and that helps them socialize the animals. Not only have these volunteers fostered animals, some have adopted some of the dogs they've taken in. This is actually called a foster failure. Tim Bruchero has been fostering for about a year, and he loves that he's saving a dog's life.
And these dogs, after working with them, it's like they know that they get a second chance, and they're just great dogs overall.
Bruchero says his permanent dog loves the company. Another foster parent, Emily Entelkofer, says that you can get attached to some of the dogs, which makes it hard to give them up.
Some are harder than others. My first foster was an emaciated pit bull that I got almost a year ago, and there are some days even now that I tear up thinking about him.
But she follows the family on Facebook and is thrilled with the life the dog now has. She says it's rewarding to see the dogs thriving.
It is a lot of work to have a dog, to house train them. Usually they're not housebroken, to get them socialized. But to see them go to their homes with lessons that you've taught them, they have a renewed faith in humans. It's amazing. There's just absolutely nothing like it.
Wallace knows that sometimes people are reluctant to adopt foster animals, but she stresses that their adoption program should ease anyone's fears.
They're house trained, they're crate trained, they have basic skills under their belt. Our foster homes know them really well. You're just not going to get that sometimes, where someone can really give you that kind of professional feedback on a dog that you're looking at adopting.
Wallace says over 700 dogs have been saved through the Black Dog Animal Rescue, and she is pushing the volunteers hard to increase that number substantially in future months. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
That's our program for this week. If you'd like to hear it again, you can find it online at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
You can also send us ideas for future programs on that site, submit an essay, and sign up for our podcast. For those of you on Facebook, we invite you to become a fan of Wyoming Public Radio News by clicking on the like button. And for news updates and less important information, you can also follow all of us on Twitter. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.